October 8th, 2023. The time is 18:42 Eastern Daylight Time. 18:42 hours, that is. Ward Green with you again. For today's study, we're looking at paragraph 8-7, chapter 8, paragraph 7, that is, of Born and Raised, which is our most recent article, the one we've been studying. So we looked at Jesus and his pre-human existence a little bit in the previous paragraph, comparing the date when the pre-human Jesus was leading the Israelites from the Exodus until the death of Moses with the time of its mirror date, which was the Habsburgs, Frederick III, ruling from 1452 to 1493 of the Common Era, whereas the Exodus was 1493 before the Common Era, exactly the same number, but prior to the turn of the Common Era, and the death of Moses, 1452, was also exactly the same number in the BCE years as the beginning of the rule of Frederick III in the Common Era. So those dates are quite remarkable. The above shows that it is important for faithful ones to realize how Jesus in his pre-human existence played a significant role in Jehovah's dealings with mankind. According to Proverbs 8:30, the pre-human Jesus had an even more important role long before Israel existed as a nation, and before even Adam was created, serving as a master builder with Jehovah and creating all things. Proverbs 8:22, together with Colossians 1:15, shows that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation, and he is the earliest of Jehovah's achievements of long ago. He received the name Jesus, or its Hebrew equivalent, Yehoshua, only when he was born to his human mother. Also, he is known as Michael the Archangel, who defeats the devil at Revelation 12:7. And is mentioned also in Daniel and Jude as being foremost of Jehovah's angels. He is the antitypical king for whom Solomon served as the type. And with King Solomon being a very wise king over Israel at the height of Israel's earthly glory, a time of great significance for God's people, because it is the time when the first temple of Jehovah was built, it is clear that he prefigures the Messiah, in a sense. Right. That is King Solomon, with him being a very wise king, prefigures the Messiah. It is clear. In other words, King Solomon is a prophetic type for a greater antitypical king who was the hope of Israel. Type and antitype means the type signifies a lesser fulfillment. The antitype signifies a larger fulfillment of the same type, or the same prophecy. So, the prophecy was that there would be a Messiah. So, the type of the Messiah was King Solomon. He was a very wise and very significant ruler of Israel. So, he prefigured the Messiah by being like the Messiah in some ways. But of course, he didn't do the things Jesus did. He didn't come close to the antitypical version of himself, who was Jesus. Jesus is sometimes called the King of Kings, of course, as also is Jehovah. Like Father, like Son. And we have so many things here. I think we should look up Proverbs chapter 8. But first of all, Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Little children, today's proverb, do not hurry yourself, verse 2, as regards your mouth. And as for your heart, let it not be hasty to bring forth a word before the true God. For the true God is in the heavens, but you are on the earth. That is why your words should prove to be few. So there's so much good advice in the Bible telling us, you know, to not talk so much. Is generally, that's good advice. And not to be hasty to speak. Those are really good tips on how to live well, you know, is to be careful what we speak, what we say, how we speak, when we speak. Be careful about those things and not to be hasty. But the wording that's given there is probably the best wording that we could ever imagine for it. Rather than any attempt on our part to describe it in any better words, because it's God's word. It's so well written and so perfectly ordained for us in order to help us to understand. This whole chapter of Ecclesiastes, of course, is quite interesting too. Useful. What happened here? Oh yeah. Well, the whole book of Ecclesiastes is talking about the vanity of life, the vanity of, you know, vanity meaning useless or hopelessness, you know, the it's vanity in every sense. I mean, it's, we tend to be making more of ourselves than perhaps we should. If we, for example, talk too much, that's one example, but that's only one way in which we can be vain. But vanity also refers to the fact that we're going to die. We know we're going to die, and it's vain. Everything we do during our lives is going to basically be left to someone else when we die. So it's, there's a lot of vanity in life. You know, the things, the wind swirls around and comes back to the same place. The water flows into the ocean, then evaporates and comes back as rainfall, and all of that is part of Ecclesiastes and the vanity of existence, the cycles of life. They're just cycles of life. It's so vain. That's part of life, and it's the part that's so thoroughly dealt with by the book of Ecclesiastes. What else have we got? We've got Judges chapter 2. This is interesting. You're right. Okay. I mean, yes, the Israelites have now conquered the promised land, but we saw that they did not drive out the nations who were inhabiting that land that they were promised. The Israelites were supposed to drive them out, and they didn't do that. We saw that recently, just yesterday in chapter 1 of Judges, we saw the Israelites didn't drive out these other nations in almost every case mentioned there. There were a number of tribes there that were listed, none of whom drove out the inhabitants of the land. Then Jehovah's angel went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I proceeded to bring you up out of Egypt and to bring you into the land about which I swore to your forefathers. Furthermore, I said, never shall I break my covenant with you. And for your part, you must not conclude a covenant with the inhabitants of this land. Their altars you should pull down. But you have not listened to my voice. Why have you done this? So I, in turn, have said, I shall not drive them away from before you, and they must become snares to you, and their gods will serve as a lure to you. So, the Israelites didn't do what they were told. They didn't pull down the altars of these foreign peoples, these other peoples who were not servants of Jehovah. And it came about that as soon as Jehovah's angel had spoken these words to all the sons of Israel, the people began to raise their voices and weep. Hence, they called the name of that place Bochim. Bochim means weepers. And they proceeded to sacrifice there to Jehovah. When Joshua sent the people away, then the sons of Israel went their way, each to his inheritance, to take possession of the land. And the people continued to serve Jehovah all the days of Joshua and all the days of the older men who extended their days after Joshua and who had seen all of Jehovah's great work that he did for Israel. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of Jehovah, died at the age of 110 years. So they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath Heres, in the mountainous region of Ephraim, on the north of Mount Gaash. And all that generation, too, were gathered to their fathers, and another generation began to rise after them that did not know Jehovah or the work that he had done for Israel. And the sons of Israel fell to doing what was bad in the eyes of Jehovah and serving the Baals. Thus they abandoned Jehovah, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt and went following other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were all around them. And they began bowing down to them, so that they offended Jehovah. Thus they abandoned Jehovah and took up serving Baal and the Ashtoreth images. At this, Jehovah's anger blazed against Israel, so that he gave them into the hands of the pillagers, and they began to pillage them, and he proceeded to sell them into the hand of their enemies round about. And they were no longer able to stand before their enemies, and everywhere that they went out, the hand of Jehovah proved to be against them for calamity, just as Jehovah had spoken and just as Jehovah had sworn to them, and they got to be in very sore straits. So Jehovah would raise up judges, and they would save them out of the hand of their pillagers. And even to their judges they did not listen, but they had immoral intercourse with other gods and went bowing down to them. They quickly turned aside from the way in which their forefathers had walked by obeying the commandments of Jehovah. They did not do like that, and when Jehovah did raise up judges for them, Jehovah proved to be with the judge. And he saved them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For Jehovah would feel regret over their groaning because of their oppressors and those who were shoving them around. And it occurred that when the judge died, they would turn around and act more ruinously than their fathers by walking after other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not refrain from their practices and their stubborn behavior. Finally, Jehovah's anger blazed against Israel, and he said, for the reason that this nation have overstepped my covenant that I commanded their forefathers and have not listened to my voice, I too for my part shall not drive out again from before them a single one of the nations that Joshua left behind when he died. In order by them to test Israel, whether they will be keepers of Jehovah's way by walking in it just as their fathers kept it or not. Accordingly, Jehovah let these nations stay by not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into Joshua's hand. So we saw already Joshua died at the end of the book of Joshua, but this is just recapping here in chapter 2 of Judges what happened during the time of Joshua and the conquest of the promised land by the Israelites. Jehovah did not give these nations into Joshua's hand. They were supposed to tear down their altars, the Israelites were. They were supposed to drive out the people and make them feel that they had to leave so that the Israelites could live in the land by themselves and not be tempted by these other forms of worship, but they didn't do that. They didn't pull down the altars. They didn't listen to Jehovah. And that is why Jehovah let these nations remain. And then, of course, we see what happened later. Each time the Israelites turned away from Jehovah and the judge who was serving at that time, or as soon as they started to have immoral intercourse with other gods in verse 17, then they got into great trouble with Jehovah, so that he allowed them to be made subject to these other nations, and they were made to be in servitude to these other nations. And only when, in verse 18, Jehovah raised up judges for them, and Jehovah was with the judge, did Jehovah then, by means of that judge, save Israel out of the hand of their enemies for the days of that judge. So there were judges, and there were times when Israel was under oppression. And that's what the dating of the book of Judges is based on, are the times of oppression and the times of the judges, which were the times of peace, when Israel had peace during the rulership of the judge, whichever judge it happened to be at the time. When the judge died in verse 19, they turned around and became bad actors again, walked after false gods, and finally, Jehovah said he would not drive out any of the nations in verse 21, the nations that Joshua had left behind. So Jehovah is a just God. He has a righteous rule, and he doesn't let people go unpunished when they disobey him. 1 Peter chapter 4. What do we have now? How are we doing here? Well, we're doing well, but we have lots of time. So 1 Peter chapter 4, we just finished Joshua, Judges chapter 2. Joshua, we just read a couple of days ago, we finished that book of Joshua, but we just saw, we had a brief review of Joshua there. In the book of Judges chapter 2, it mentioned Joshua, at least, right? So we know that. And 1 Peter chapter 4. Now this is not the last chapter of this book. There are five chapters in 1 Peter. And this is Peter writing to the temporary residents, as he called them, in chapter 1. To the temporary residents scattered about in various places, right? To the ones chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. There was a foreknowledge. God knew in advance that this was going to be happening, that there would be chosen believers that would rule with Christ in heaven, this was a sacred secret that is also called that in various places in the Christian scriptures too. It's called a sacred secret. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the flesh, chapter 4 of 1 Peter, Peter writes, you too arm yourselves with the same mental disposition, because the person that has suffered in the flesh has desisted from sins to the end that he may live the remainder of his time in the flesh, no more for the desires of men, but for God's will. For the time that has passed by is sufficient for you to have worked out the will of the nations when you proceeded in deeds of loose conduct, lusts, excesses with wine, revelries, drinking matches, and illegal idolatries. Because you do not continue running with them in this course to the same low sink of debauchery, they are puzzled and go on speaking abusively of you. But these people will render an account to the one ready to judge those living and those dead. In fact, for this purpose the good news was declared also to the dead, that they might be judged as to the flesh from the standpoint of men, but might live as to the spirit from the standpoint of God. But the end of all things has drawn close. Be sound in mind, therefore, and be vigilant with a view to prayers. Above all things, have intense love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another, without grumbling. In proportion as each one has received a gift, use it in ministering to one another as fine stewards of God's undeserved kindness expressed in various ways. If anyone speaks, let him speak, as it were, the sacred pronouncements of God. If anyone ministers, let him minister as dependent on the strength that God supplies, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. The glory and the might are His forever and ever. Amen. Beloved ones, do not be puzzled at the burning among you, which is happening to you for a trial, as though a strange thing were befalling you. On the contrary, go on rejoicing, for as much as you are sharers in the sufferings of the Christ, that you may rejoice and be overjoyed also during the revelation of His glory. If you are being reproached for the name of Christ, you are happy, because the Spirit of glory, even the Spirit of God, is resting upon you. However, let none of you suffer as a murderer, or a thief, or an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. But if he suffers as a Christian, let him not feel shame, but let him keep on glorifying God in this name. For it is the appointed time for the judgment to start with the house of God. Now if it starts first with us, what will be the end of those who are not obedient to the good news of God? And if the righteous man is being saved with difficulty, where will the ungodly man and the sinner make a showing? So then also let those who are suffering in harmony with the will of God keep on commending their souls to a faithful Creator while they are doing good. That's the end of 1 Peter chapter 4. Now look at this part where it says in verse 6, the good news was declared also to the dead. Who are the dead? Well, Jesus said in Matthew 8 and 22, if I'm reading that correctly, 8 and 22, keep following me and let the dead bury their dead. So those who do not believe are considered dead in Jehovah's eyes. So when Peter says the good news was declared also to the dead, that shows that we don't just preach to the other believers, we also preach to the unbelievers. And we tell them the good news. And that allows that they can be judged according to the flesh from the standpoint of men and live as to the Spirit from the standpoint of God. one or other of those may happen, perhaps, or maybe both. But the end of all things has drawn close. So there, Peter mentions the end of all things. Now, in his day, when he wrote this, he wrote this book before the end of the Jewish system. I believe that's when we have the dating for this. I'm not sure what the date of the letters of Peter are exactly, but I think they're in the years before the destruction of Jerusalem, certainly, because if Jerusalem had already been destroyed, he wouldn't be saying the end has drawn close. The end would have already come if Jerusalem and the temple had already been destroyed. So it shows that at the time that Peter wrote this, it was at the very latest, it was in the years of the 60s of the Common Era, not as late as 70, unless it was in the year 70 prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in the sort of in the summertime of that year. Is that correct? I think that's right. I'm trying to think what the date was. I think it was very similar to the same time when it was destroyed in 587 BCE. The time of the year was similar, actually. I'm trying to think, when was it destroyed? Well, that's something we'll have to look up again. But whenever it was in the year 70, Peter wrote this apparently prior to that, because the end of all things had not arrived. And in his mind, the end of all things would have been very, very adequately fulfilled by the destruction of the Jewish temple. That would have been essentially the end of all things for someone who was raised as a Jew, as Peter was, and who became a Christian, one of the 12 apostles of Jesus, and it's okay to suffer as a Christian as long as we're doing good and not doing bad things such as stealing, murdering, doing evil, or being a busybody and not minding our own business, in other words. So Christians should mind their own business and not meddle with other people's matters. In other words, you know, mind their own things. And when you do good things, you can suffer, and you don't have to be ashamed of suffering. It's not something to be ashamed of, he says. Suffering as a Christian, it's not something to feel shame about. But also, he says, the judgment is going to start with the house of God, and Christians will be judged first. It says, he says, the judgment starts with the house of God. Well, that's interesting, too, because we know the Jewish temple was judged, and the Jews were judged first. And in other words, the Jewish judgment arrived in 70 CE when the temple was destroyed by the Romans. That is the point at which the judgment started with the house of God, too. We could say that that's true, right? So that's fascinating. So I never thought of this before exactly. Starting with the house of God, the judgment came upon the Jewish temple in 70 CE. So Peter was prophesying that very thing in verse 17. That's one interpretation of that. So, they were the house of God. They didn't survive that judgment. The temple was destroyed. They didn't survive the judgment. So, if they didn't survive it and they were God's people, then how's it going to be for the rest of us who were not God's people originally, but are just hearing the good news now as part of the nations, or we're from the nations that were not Jewish, and we didn't have the pronouncements of God all along, but we're hearing the good news? How are we going to avoid being judged is a good question, because even the Jews did not escape judgment themselves, and they were God's people. That's very true. That's very true. But in verse 14, if we're being reproached for the name of Christ, we're happy. Verse 14. So, yeah, I'm learning about the problems I've had because of my overdose of vitamin D that I've been taking for some years, and more so recently. I've been learning some of the different symptoms that were caused by the vitamin D, one of which was dehydration. I was so dehydrated, I was drinking water every few seconds, or, you know, very often when I was making my videos. I had to keep drinking water continually because I was so dehydrated. And yet, I was drinking water constantly, but I was still dehydrated. Now I'm not drinking any water, and I'm not dehydrated. So the dehydration was caused by the massive amount of vitamin D. And, it's quite a change. Another thing I noticed, my earwax became much stiffer and much more brittle. It was not soft. My earwax was not soft. My eczema got worse on my face. My eczema was worse. And now my eczema is better and my earwax is soft again. So the eczema is a symptom of some kind of some kind of bacteria possibly, or some kind of microscopic life form growing on your skin. That's what eczema could be. And also, I had these kind of things behind my ears too. I had something, I guess it was like eczema, behind my ears. And that's gotten a lot better since I've stopped taking vitamin D and stopped taking calcium for a while too. So my food is different now, because I'm not eating calcium either. And that's pretty well all I have to say right now, because we're out of time for today. So it's October 8th, 2023. The time is 19:15 hours, Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you. Have a wonderful time for the rest of your day. This is my beloved Crow and Cassie on my behalf saying, bye for now.